I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes. Nice
dress. It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Welcome to the Critter Shed. And today, Colly and I are visiting a very good friend of ours in a place that we have spent quite a bit of time in the past. I used to live here for a while, but not anymore. We're in Dublin Zoo. And the animal that we're here to talk about is a type of antelope that comes from North Africa. And it's called the scimitar-horned oryx. And the person who knows loads about this gorgeous animal is the one and only zookeeper Brendan Walsh. He actually spent a bit of time in North Africa studying this animal. And of course, he cares for them as well in their habitat in Dublin Zoo. We hope you enjoy.
So we are up in the African Plains part of the zoo, specifically the African savannah. So in this part of the zoo, we've got scimitar-horned oryx, we've got giraffe, and we've got zebra. And right next to them, we have white rhinoceros as well. A scimitar-horned oryx is a species of antelope. They're about, 1.5 metres tall. They've got quite a white body with kind of a reddish-brown neck. Mm-hmm. They've got the large horns, which the name refers to a scimitar sword, I believe. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't think I've ever seen a scimitar sword, but that's what maybe you probably have.
I have, yeah.
So that's what they're named after. From a kind of like anecdotal children's point of view, they're believed to be one of the origins of the unicorn, as in the myth of the unicorn. In Egypt, sometimes they used to tie the horns together when they were young and make one horn, apparently. And also, if the course of one is broken off, which I'm sure happens occasionally, it looks like one horn as well. And also if you're looking from the side, they look like it looks like one horn as well. What's most kind of motivating about this species is that they are a species that's extinct in the wild. However, they're a species that is now returning from extinction. So basically, they were never completely extinct or extinct in the wild. So there was some left in zoos in Europe and North America, and they were basically moved from those zoos to Tunisia in the 80s. And I'm glad to say it's been really successful. So even one from one oryx that was sent from our society, Zoological Society of Ireland, Brilliant. Was sent over, a male from Fowdo Wildlife Park. And so genetically, it's a good founder population. There was none left in North Africa, absolutely none. Right. So we believe they went extinct in the mid-80s. Probably the last one was seen in Chad. And they were officially declared extinct in the wild in 2000. But they were extinct from...
Why was that? Was it because of the antlers or poaching or trophy hunting?
As above, but also climate change.
Okay.
So desertification. Mm-hmm. Desertification. I was having a problem saying that. So basically the savannah, the Sahara Desert is growing north and south. It's getting bigger and bigger, as you know. So that's obviously... The oryx was often described as a desert species, but really it's not.
Okay.
They can live in very hot environments, but really they want to be in an arid environment.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And same with the camels and so many other species. I believe the addax is quite a good desert species.
Okay.
But really the scimitar-horned oryx species is an animal that wants to live in an arid land and wants to have occasional moisture, has to have access to vegetation.
Yeah.
And the problem with climate change is obviously the air is becoming drier abnormally quick now.
Yeah.
The rainy seasons aren't as long. And then on top of that, then you've got people, the population, human populations growing. Their camels, their goats, their sheep populations are growing, and then unfortunately they're overgrazing, and that's causing problems for them. Unfortunately, parts of North Africa especially have had a lot of war in the last few decades, and that's caused problems as well. And understandably, people aren't going to be too worried about conservation, unfortunately, when their lives are at stake.
Yeah.
So that's a big problem. The arrival of the rifle has been a disaster for so many animals, be it in Africa or any other continent. Prior to that, the oryx would have had some sort of chance of escaping humans, mm-hmm. whereas now there's some horrible videos on YouTube and elsewhere. I've seen when I was in Tunisia of people that will fly in for the weekend, weekend. They'll jump on their high-speed jeeps, their high-speed quads. They'll have rifles with them, mm-hmm. and they'll go shooting gazelle, oryx, whatever they can get their shots fired at. So that's obviously horrific, and that's why their numbers went down to zero.
Yeah. Could you tell us a bit about it? Because I'm just looking at them here now. They're quite sturdy-looking antelopes. Type creatures. They're absolutely beautiful with those gorgeous swooping horns. The horns sweep back towards their backs and they have brown on the front and white at the back. They're really handsome looking animals. Tell us a bit, are they herd animals? What type of place do they live in? What do they eat?
I definitely recommend, if you're listening to this and you've never seen one, I definitely recommend get on Mr. Google and have a look, yeah. and see how beautiful they are. I think they are cracking. Yeah. They are a herd animal generally. So you'll have a herd of adult females with their offspring and one dominant male. What seems to be the case, and again, as people in Tunisia have told me, they're still learning about them. They're still not certain of exactly how the herds definitely work. I love how they're not certain on their answers. They say, we're still learning, we think it's this. But they would say that a dominant female could be leading the herd, but the overall dominant animal is the bull, and he's walking from behind, and he's steering the group from there.
Leading from behind.
I know, I kind of read that and I kind of went, interesting, you know, but that's apparently the case. And I've heard about that with, I think wolves, I think might do something similar as well, but I wouldn't know much about that. But it's an interesting one. So when you see them in the zoo, and in any zoo I've seen them, you always come across as quite docile, quite calm, and that's basically how I've always seen them. However, again, the joy of YouTube, I've seen some videos of where bulls are full on fighting, and that's a whole different ballgame.
The bits with those scimitars,
so those horns are, what are they, well over a meter long, and at the base they've got lots of ridges, so this is where nature's obviously helping them, that the horns don't go right down to their face often, so a lot of the momentum is on the horns, and so sometimes of course they will damage each other, hurt each other, but as with a lot of fights in nature, I think the ultimate goal is to prove who's stronger, and ideally the weaker one gets away with their life if they're lucky enough. So, but yeah, seeing them in action is quite impressive. Going to Tunisia was amazing. You know, seeing them in the wild, absolutely stunning. And it's you need inspiration sometimes in life, don't you? You know what I mean? You need motivation to know that we're doing these things for a reason. And it's to see them, to know that they went from zero to what do you reckon now, probably about 600 across North Africa.
That's an amazing number, and it's a testament to the value of zoos and keeping that genetic well there to bring it back, because otherwise you're talking about bottlenecks and you know, where a population wouldn't be that healthy.
Absolutely, and that's it. That's why it's so important that the animals that we have now, we're careful about how we breed them, and that's why stud book keepers, the men and women, will tell zoos, right, you can breed this year, don't breed this year, please breed next year, whatever. It's important to get that information, because we, like you say, bottlenecks, if we were to breed everything this year and every other zoo was to breed everything this year, within 12 months, 15 months, 18 months, every zoo is going to be overloaded with animals, and then your bottleneck is coming to you a lot closer. Yeah. So you're trying to postpone or eliminate the chance of a genetic bottleneck. I was talking to a lady yesterday from Texas, and I know that over there there's about 4,000 scimitar horned oryx. And so they're part of shooting ranges. So basically, people pay in to shoot them.
Oh my god!
Yes. So it's certainly not a black and white topic, is it? So it's a case of I'd love to know what their genetics are like. I mean, if they're genetically well, I'd love to know, are they potentially animals that could go back to the wild someday? I don't know. But the ones in zoos certainly are sound genetically.
Yeah, so going back to the wild, how does that work? Maybe just talk us through how animals like the oryx can be reintroduced.
So I think, I can't think of any exceptions. Basically, every animal that goes back to the wild, every species that goes back to the wild, has to be done in a soft release. So you'd bring them, ideally, in a zoo environment, ideally, depending on the species, say, for example, the oryx, you either start with a family herd or youngsters, fly them over and get them there as quick as possible, put them into a soft release area, start them off with, a close enough area that they can see that as their homestead. So maybe big stables or something like that, leave them there for a day or two, that they get relaxed and they realise, okay, this is where we are now. Letting them straight into a big massive pen isn't the wisest thing to do. Then gradually, have them in a pen that's hopefully a couple of acres in size, and get them used to the climate, to the keepers, to the handlers that are nearby. And when you think that they've got used to the local feeds that are there, that they know where the water source is, that the animals are looking well, that you think they're strong enough, you know, that they've passed all the necessary veterinary tests. Obviously, that should be done before they fly to the country as well, of course. But before they release, make sure that they've got no parasites on their body or inside their body, ecto or endoparasites. So things like that you want to make sure are all good. And then eventually they get released. So again, when they get released from that area, they're still not completely in the wild. They're in a much bigger area then. So that's why the scimitar horned oryx is still classed as extinct in the wild, because they are still in fenced areas.
Okay.
Now, these are areas that are thousands of acres in size, mm-hmm. but this is why they're still classed as extinct in the wild. So they still have dangers. Animals can still get in, wolves can get in. Obviously, these habitats are natural, mm-hmm. so there is predators there, and there's plenty of benefits to that as well, because it keeps them on their toes and it keeps them moving in natural situations, in natural movement. So yeah, we saw lots. We saw the golden wolf, we saw red fox, we saw gerbils.
Gerbils.
Yeah. That's something. Yeah,
gerbils aren't eating the antelope, are they?
No, definitely not. Definitely not. You see them at night time. We were lucky enough to bump into two vets from Belgium, and they had lots of amazing night vision cameras, which I don't think we could afford.
Yeah.
And
amazing. Fantastic.
And it just opened up a whole new world. And but yeah, we put out little bait traps, and so we have the camera traps out there as well. So they're doing ongoing surveys to see what animals are there, and they're using that information all the time to see how the habitat is doing.
And it is important, I suppose, that the predators too can get in at them, because it will, again, when they go out into the world, you're not going to be holding their horns. You know what I mean? So yeah. It is important that they get a real feel of what's coming.
I think so. And like, it is what you might term as like negative enrichment.
Yes.
But again, that's
a great term.
It's you know, not every enrichment has to be here's a lot of food and isn't that lovely, off you go. Mm-hmm. It's keeping, like, they've evolved over millions of years to be the animals they are and to behave the way they are. So if you take those things away from them when you're trying to release them back to the wild, well, of course, you're not going to do them any favours.
Can't bubble wrap them.
You know, nature is a tough place, as you know.
Yeah.
And you know, so at the start when you're breeding them and in the zoo environment, obviously you want them to survive as well as possible, and then when they go back to the wild, well, you have to start giving them some tests.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where, you know, ideally, you know, lots of calves survive. That's the calves are really the animals that get preyed upon.
Yeah.
I didn't hear of any adults getting preyed upon. I'd imagine when they get older they must do.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was there, it was the calves that were the problem. And especially when they're born, the mother will often leave the herd that she's in, and that could be 10, 20 animals. We saw one herd that's 29 animals, and the calves go super quick. Like, we've had lots of calves born here over the years, and I can't believe, like, if you're not under section and you come back a month later, like, what? How quickly they grow.
Yeah.
Like a lot of herbivores, it's in their interest to grow fast.
Yeah.
They can walk after an hour of being born. And that's why you'll often see mothers eating the umbilical cord, the amniotic fluid, everything that comes out basically with the baby. The mothers will often eat. It's considered a good source of animal protein for the mother, but probably more importantly, it's a time for the smell to disappear, clean it up,
and
get moving, you know. So it's interesting.
What's the time scale for a full release?
For the oryx, I mean, that started in the mid-80s. I think it was Phoenix Zoo, I think it was Edinburgh Zoo, and nowadays Marwell Zoo and Dublin Zoo. Like, Dublin Zoo is one of only about five zoos that are with the project.
Mm-hmm.
Marwell Zoo are very much leading the project. So that's since the mid-80s. I think London Zoo are part of that as well. So that's 35 years ago, 38 years ago.
It's a long process.
And of course, it depends on the species. For some other smaller animals, like birds of prey and that, I'm guessing it would be shorter time.
Yeah.
But of course, the big thing is that the dangers that got them to that stage, they obviously have to be gone.
Yes.
You know, we could say, let's fly lots of baby gorillas over to Africa tomorrow, but the bush meat trade, the all these threats are still there.
Yeah.
So it doesn't make sense to send them back until those dangers are gone.
Mm-hmm.
So it takes a while for these projects to last, and it's certainly a long term project. So with this, it's as I might have said to you before, they're very much the flagship species, the charismatic species, mm-hmm. the oryx in this project. But, you know, I saw a desert frog. Well, I can't remember what species it was. But I thought of it yourself, because obviously you're interested in your reptiles and your amphibians. And it was just one small little stream, and boom, there was a frog.
Yeah.
And so what I love about the oryx project is that the you're saving all the different animals, you know, all the different species. Same with the orangutan project in Borneo and the chimp project.
It's that trickle-down effect from the charismatic megafauna.
Absolutely. You know, not everyone might be interested in a centipede or a spider or a tick.
I know.
You know what I mean?
I've
but
noticed.
Yeah, for sure. You know.
Can I just say that we're being eyeballed by one, two, three, four, five, six giraffes and a very curious looking zebra who's having a pee. And the oryx are coming over to us now.
They're all coming in soon. So the keepers from this section will be opening up these gates soon. But they all each species knows their own gate. So they all come in separately at night time. And then what we'll do is the gates will be opened back up for the likes of the zebra. Mm. So you can hear the oryx. They're having a bit of a clash behind us now.
Oh,
see?
Oh, yeah. You hear that? Brilliant. So both sexes are horned.
Yes. And when you read about the horns, it really only ever describes the horns being for males for fighting. But I would imagine.
Wow, look at them go. They're running now.
Running around. It's great to see.
Oh, it's fantastic.
Jumanji part two. Yeah. Or part three at this stage.
But we've seen the female horns.
The females have horns as well. So I would imagine that's for defence as well. I've never heard of the females fighting. The males fight to defend their herd or to get a herd, one or the other. So I would imagine it makes sense that the females have horns for defence.
Wow.
That's brilliant.
That bang.
You're in luck. Did you hear that sound? Beautiful, isn't it?
They're really having a go at each other.
Yeah.
It's brilliant. This is like watching the UFC. It's fantastic. I'm having a ball here.
It is great to see. And the great thing, of course, about this place as well, this place was originally created in 2000, and then our former director, Leo Oosterweegel, redesigned it in 2009. We opened it in 2009. And so now it's got the three species together, and the ground drains very well.
Brilliant.
So these are animals that would grow, that would live in a dry habitat. Occasionally, mm-hmm. obviously, there's rains and things like that, but generally they're on a dry habitat. So that's why it's important that when they're walking around, that for their feet have evolved to live on, you know, sometimes sandy areas, and obviously, but generally dry areas. And that's another thing interesting about the, you know, I mentioned earlier on about them being not realistically, they don't want to be a desert species. They're sometimes getting pushed into deserts, and that's what causes the numbers to go down. But I'm just getting distracted by the clashing heads here.
It makes sense that they're not a desert species because they're so big. I mean, like, any herbivore that size could not survive on sand dunes alone.
Speaking of, so if they are surviving in a place where there's very little water, how does their body adapt to having so little water?
This is where they're so amazing. So they can go without water often from the end of a rainy season to the start of the next rainy season, which can be 10 months.
My God.
Insane. So already, like before the interference of humans, say go back 100, 150 years, prior to that, they already had a very tough life to get by. To get to adulthood, to produce a baby was hard. Mm. So now humans have added those problems. But their bodies, they can actually raise their internal body temperature so that they're less affected by heat.
Wow.
So we're obviously 37.1 degrees. They go warmer than that, which means...
Sorry, look at that one prancing there. Did you see that?
That
the way they move is incredible. Just... Yeah. Oh, stunning.
We've actually moved four aurochs out recently, so I'm wondering, is this behaviour, is it a kind of a reassertion
the pecking order?
The pecking order being re-established. So, and that's the thing, you know, if people were to stand at each area all day, every day, they'll definitely see some behaviours.
Yeah.
If you go past every area and look at them for 2 minutes, you'll definitely miss a lot of things.
Yeah.
But we've been standing here for, 10, 15 minutes, and we've seen them. We've seen each species move. We've seen chasing. We've seen clashing of heads.
Oh, the oryx went for the zebra there. Did you see that little Sorry, back to the... So they can raise their internal temperature, as you were saying.
Yeah, so that basically means they get less affected by the heat, and they sweat less, which of course means they lose less water. Where they get... Obviously, they're mammals, and they do need to get moisture. So where they get the moisture from is from the vegetation. This is why they need to be in the arid areas.
So for 10 months I couldn't give up Guinness for 10 days, let alone war.
Delicious.
That's
Guinness.
Mad.
It's a tough one for them. But what's interesting as well is that, again, they're from the arid areas, and the problem is a lot of their trees were cut down. So people needed firewood for everything else. So when it's really hot, I'm sure you've walked in city streets on a hot day. If you go down a city street with no trees, you're roasting hot. The heat is just bouncing off the ground and you're roasting hot. You go down a street with trees during the summer and all those leaves, you're in amazing shade, and it's just unbelievable. I've seen it myself in the zoo. You go 1 meter to the left and suddenly you're in the shade.
Yeah.
The difference is massive. Yeah. So for humans, for oryx, for every animal in the wild, they are crepuscular, of course, as well, meaning they're active morning and evening. And I can't think of many mammals that are still active in the middle of the day. It doesn't make sense to go looking for vegetation. If they're going to rest, it's going to be the middle of the hottest part of the day. So from, say, 10:30 till 2:30, a lot of species, be it a gorilla or be it especially animals in the hotter areas like the oryx, they want to lie down and disappear if they can and get into shade. But the Sahara, the northern part of Africa, that's such a bizarre and amazing history. And you go back a long time ago, it was forest.
Yes,
then
right.
It became the grassland savanna, didn't it? And then I believe way before that, it was the bottom of the ocean, if I'm not mistaken. But what's made the base of the Sahara now so amazing is the substrate. So the winds blow westerly across that, over the Atlantic Ocean and into South America. And one of the reasons they believe South America's rainforest is so rich is because basically they're getting fertilized to this day by the Sahara.
Wow.
Because that ground is so rich in minerals. So you'll often hear like, oh, in Spain and Southern Europe, does storms from the Sahara, and it's seen as a bad thing. And of course it is, if your lovely white car is sitting out in the drive and it gets destroyed, you're not too keen. But from when I heard that, I was just like, this is mental. You think you know how the earth works, and of course I never will know fully. Yeah. But you hear things like that, you're just like, when you know the size of planet Earth and how one continent is benefiting another with its dust. It's vital dust.
What's the trees that they would have been hiding under acacia and stuff like that?
Acacia, I think, is the main one.
Same story all over Africa. Acacia. It's nearly the exact same story in East Africa as well. The same stuff you've been talking about, like human expansion, decimation of forest regions, all that sort of same stuff is affecting animals all over. So,
and also, I was wondering as well, I heard a story about, just to briefly go back to their adaptations, I heard about their poo and how that helps them to... Tell me a bit about their poo.
Let's talk about the shite.
Yeah. It's always good and bright. So the poo is very dry, of course, as you can imagine. They're not going to waste losing moisture in it. So it comes out very dry. And the longest serving keeper that worked with our orcs here was John O'Connor, a great man. And I remember him calling them Maltesers.
Which
made it feel a lot more exciting.
That's a very good description,
isn't it? And it was always nice to... made it more motivating when you're raking them up. You could be raking them up for an hour a day.
I have a story about that, because I remember you mentioned Leo Osterwagel, who, full disclosure, is my other half. So Leo, when he worked at the zoo here, he had an idea that he wanted to put on a poo exhibition.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So he spent months collecting, through keepers like yourself, all sorts of shit from around the place, which would be delivered to bags, nice and fresh, to our house, which then would be unpacked...
Wow. Brilliant.
Onto our
really
dining table.
Yes. Why not?
Hopefully after dinner.
And then dried on the radiators.
Mm-hmm.
But I do remember the oryx poo being really small little pellets. And to see these little pellets coming out of such big animals is extraordinary. So that's obviously a very important part of their body, squeezing every bit of moisture, retaining it in their bodies and not letting it go with the...
Their intestine, their kidneys, you know, everything is working hard.
Yeah.
Don't waste water. I'd imagine their urination is correspondingly less than animals from Ireland, for example.
Yeah.
The deer that would live in Ireland, things like that.
Ten months without water.
Crazy. Well, that's it. Yeah, and this is where, again, it gets great in Tunisia, because one man, Ahmed, I forget his surname, Dr. Ahmed, I remember, it was his first title, but he in Bouhedma National Park, if I remember correctly, he created basically a reservoir. So basically the water was coming down from the mountains through the normal processes of condensation and things like that, and rain obviously landing, and dew landing on top of the mountains and gradually coming down the streams. But because the habitat had been so destroyed and overgrazed, when the water got to the lower parts, it was basically disappearing. It wasn't really to any benefit, it was just leaching through the ground. So, clever man that he is, he created a reservoir and then gradually released the water through funnels, through basically the streams. And this is where we saw one of those frogs. And very clever man, really knows his plants, so he planted the whole area up as well. And just by that one reservoir, that was the kickstart to the whole project. So a man that was really involved with horticulture was massively a part of helping the species. And obviously, like we said earlier on, it's no point in sending these animals back with all the greatest intentions and all the money in the world unless the habitat is returning. And you also need the local people on board.
Of course, yeah.
So
that's half the battle.
Isn't it? And you have to have local people on board. You know, it's important. You know, and obviously people from around the world that are specialists as well. But you have to include the local people. Mm. Everything from making them rangers. And if they were former poachers, they probably know more about the habitat than anyone else. Get them on side, give them a fair wage. There's the animals coming in now.
I can see them all queuing up now.
Yeah.
And
so that's the giraffe,
gosh, they're magnificent.
So the giraffes are coming in
the way
for
they
it.
All queue up in line to not together in their own separate herds. That is, and they're just queuing there.
I'm sorry to jump topic now, but like, as the giraffes are coming in there, we call that like conditioning. So we basically, by doing the same thing every day, we're trying to make their day different. But the one exception is that when we're bringing them in and bringing them out of their areas, safety and their safety and their safety are paramount. So that's, you know, they're the one things you don't want to be changing. Hoofstock are very neophobic. They're very much afraid of new things. So if you were to put a bucket on the fence in there when they're coming in, they're going to freeze.
Yeah.
And in our interpretation, that we're like, you know, if you didn't know them, you'd think, well, why would you be afraid of a bucket? That's so silly. But of course,
evolutionary makes evolutionary sense, because anything out of place,
yeah,
could you're be, toast. You can
yeah,
eat
exactly,
it.
Could be
yeah.
kill you. Could be a lion's paw or something like exactly. that. You know what I mean? So it's good. So it's
and here they're the don't they look magnificent when they're walking towards us? The oryx are now walking towards us,
stunning.
And those lovely long, beautiful scimitar-shaped horns. Oh, they're magnificent creatures, Brendan.
Very riven by colour as well.
Tell us about how the and there's one looking right at us now and walking towards us. Tell us about the conservation project and the people and how it's run and what they do.
So they've employed locals. So they'd be on foot, they'd be on mopeds, little motorbikes, and they would cover a lot of land in four different national parks in Tunisia, from the north to the south. And Tunisia, of course, is the very northern tip of Africa. So it's on the Mediterranean, a beautiful country. And if you're a fan of like Indiana Jones and Star Wars movies like that, they've been filmed there. So beautiful. Beautiful part of the world. What was the question again? Sorry.
Tell us about how the conservation project works.
Oh, so the conservation project works, but basically, first of all, of course, they need the money and the animals. So that's where Dublin Zoo and say a number of other zoos are helping. Also, the Tunisian government is obviously behind the project, which is essential. And then you've got some very intelligent local people who are basically like rangers. They think they're referred to as keepers as well. And they know the animals inside out. They know the tracks. They can spot things a mile off. It's so interesting to see them. When I got there on the first day, a calf had been born, but it seemed to be quite certain that a wolf had got it already, which again most of them don't, but there was the drama. But we saw the footprints, and you know, it was amazing to see, but it was brilliant. And Dr. Marie Petretto, she was the lady that's based over there. She's works for Marwell Wildlife, and we sponsor her as well. Well, the project that she works for, she is unbelievable. Like if you're thinking of your Tomb Raider women or anything like that, this woman can do anything. She's a vet, she's a field biologist, and what's really important is that she can relate and communicate in a nice way with the local people.
Brilliant.
Which is so important.
Yeah.
You know, never condescending. Mm. Because she's like a vet, obviously a career I would have massive respect for. And the same as every vet I've met, they're down to earth. They're not like, you know, they're not preachy or anything like that. And I think that sort of attitude will go down very badly with any people in any part of the world. Mm. So there I was sitting back and watching and admiring how she was able to talk with the locals and how they respected her and just does brilliant work with them. But, you know, when we were there, a slenderhorn gazelle, of which in that area there's 21, there's only four males, and he had to have half of his leg amputated. Oh. So he had half his leg amputated, but it was starting to get infected, which of course would definitely be death very quickly. If you get septicemia, blood poisoning, you're going to be gone pretty quick. So she had to operate in the field. That operation would be hard in our lovely hospital here in Dublin Zoo, where it's sterile, where it's very clean. Sterile would be very hard, but it's where it's very clean and you've got proper big lights and you've got very clean air. There you've got dust. You know, she had me with a stethoscope on my ears, and we had just basically like, and for most of the operation we're just in the open area, and then recovery area is a bit of hessian and a covered area. So she, you know, was able to get stuck in at the end of the operation. The oryx went into cardiac arrest, and she was able to basically get him back. She pulled his tongue, which stimulates the heart, and that got him kind of jolted, and then he came around and he survived.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah.
So all out in the field.
Yes.
And you must have been learning so much from that trip. When was that trip?
That was just before COVID. I don't know if I'm allowed to say that word. And so that was November and December of 2019. Yeah. So I was very lucky to get there and get back, because obviously another 4 months later, I wouldn't have been allowed to go.
What was your biggest impression, or the biggest thing that you learned, do you think, from that trip?
Without sounding too cheesy, hope. That, like, you know, to keep you I came back more motivated to believe that there is hope, and you have to keep, and I do, and there is hope. I mean, animals and the environment are talked about more now than ever. 10 years ago, 20 years ago, I think it was a lot less in the media about the environment. Whereas now, if someone wants to build a housing estate, they have to get the trees checked for bats and, you know, ecological reports and stuff like that. I don't think that stuff was being done decades ago. So, you know, most species numbers, you know, a lot of animals, their numbers are going down, but there is plenty of species that their numbers are going up. You know, I think there was 20 species in America last week that were classified going in the right direction. The numbers are going up. So it's important to, you know, I read a lot of wildlife magazines and stuff online and documentaries, and every so often you do get a bit bogged down in the depression of it, of how bad it is.
I find them hard to watch at the moment. Well, and probably, I'd say a lot of people might be the same. You look at a beautiful David Attenborough and you think, oh, it's too depressing, because, you know.
But you have to realise, you know, there is hope. And that's why, you know, I love working in the zoo, because we are doing good things. We're trying our best. Today we opened our new conservation centre that's got IUCN backing, which basically means, like, that's the global brand in conservation. Yeah. And we're now one of the only centres on the planet. I think we're about 20 centres on the planet. So to get that accreditation is enormous. There's only a handful of zoos that have it.
Great achievement.
And yeah, we've got a new conservation research officer, and we've a new species survival officer that I've started since I last talked to you guys. So, like, our chapter ended, I think, in about 2020, where we'd spent the previous 25 years focusing on infrastructure, building a zoo that was good for the animals, good for visitors, good for staff. And then we went from probably one conservation product to about 25 in that era. Now we've moved into to a new, it feels like a new chapter for me. Now, previously, in our entire history, we were a zoo, and in the last, like, 25-30 years, we've sponsored a lot of conservation products. Now the mantra, the strategy, is going to be that we're going to be a conservation organization that runs a zoo. So and really, the proof is there. Since 2020, that's only 3 years ago, these things take time, but in that time we've become an IUCN center. We now sponsor Bat Rehab Ireland, which are amazing organization. We've just started sponsoring Seal Rescue down in County Wicklow, and hopefully we will be sponsoring more products. The goal is to sponsor a bigger proportion of Irish projects, because traditionally, I guess, you came to the zoo and you saw an elephant, a tiger, gorilla, and you probably left the place thinking not much about Irish wildlife. And of course, it's there, and
conservation starts at home. I always tell people that, and it's really important that we look after our own species, because how can you go out into the world and lecture and preach at people when we're not looking after our own wildlife?
Sorry.
You're a popular man.
sorry.
But I think that's a great note to finish on, hope. And I'm delighted that you feel that, Brendan. Yeah. That gives me hope.
Yeah. Absolutely. And it's important, you know, life is hard enough without, you know, thinking about things too badly. But watching Marie Proietto, if you ever watched the Zoo TV show, we did 3 episodes based there. I know it's repeated on channels like Eden and stuff like that, and definitely an RTE player. And she was on our live show last year as well, sending me a little hello message, which made me feel all gushy watching it on live TV. But no, that's the thing. You have to smile, and you have to think we're doing our best. And, you know, that's the motivation to keep going.
The world is a fine place and worth fighting for.
Brendan, yes, as always, it's been an absolute pleasure. It's so great to be here again.
Always a pleasure, brother. You're brilliant. And after giving me a bit of hope now, I'll go home now. All bubbly.
Thanks, Colly. Thanks, Colette. And I'm pleased to come back soon.
This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode, and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.